Hello, and welcome to Spy Hards Podcast, where your hosts go deep undercover into the world of spy movies to decipher which films make the knock list. But remember, this information is strictly for your ears only. I'm Agent Scott.
And I'm Cam the Provocateur, watching Scott shave his legs in the tub.
You can't look away, can you?
I can't.
I shave upwards.
I'm like Brian Cox.
Oh, yeah. Well, just put my shoes down, will you, at least? Well, before we get to this week's film, you've all clicked play, you all want to get to it, we know, but we need to induct a new Spy Hard diehard. Cam, how do you become one?
By leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and then we read that review on the show and give you your code nickname.
I'm sure Cam's been working hard on this code nickname. We wish we could give you more stuff. Maybe we should send you out a medal, some sort of trophy or some sort of plaque, but we haven't got that sort of budget, so you just get a code name instead.
Hey, I put work into these code names, sort of, so they are much valued in the spy community.
Sure. I'm sure people are lauding it. They're celebrating it. They're writing it on their jackets next to their two slanted pins.
This one's a good one, so okay. Whoever gets this one, you know, it's not bad.
Okay, he's building it up, folks. He's building it up. But here we go. Here is our latest inductee. And I thought this week I'd cast our net a bit wider and look at some of our international reviews. So I've looked at our Ireland Apple podcast, and we got this one recently from P. Lally. I do believe that's Paul Lally, who actually contributed to our 2023 recap episode. I suggest you go and check that out, folks. It's a great episode, but this is what he writes. From Spy Fans with Love. Always quality discussions, and I always learn something new about my favorite film genre from these guys. Very enjoyable. 5 stars.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And your nickname is going to be Penthouse 84.
I thought you said you worked really hard on these.
I'm kidding. I wouldn't saddle someone with that one. The nickname will be Nightshade.
Oh, yeah, that's a goodie. That's a good.
That's a really good one, right?
Agent Nightshade. That's a video game.
I think, wasn't that a Bond video game?
Nightfire, you're thinking of.
Nightfire, yeah, okay. Well,
great
Nightshade.
Great game.
Yeah, it was actually fun. That's like the only one I ever played on a PC. But yeah, Agent Nightshade, can't go wrong with that.
There you go. Welcome to the Spy Hards Die Hard Circle. Maybe we should make a clubhouse somewhere. Where would we put the clubhouse?
Well, it would have to be in a nondescript location that no one can find.
That's why no one's here.
That's right. That's why we are partying alone.
As usual. And speaking of partying, let's get to the review. Well, here we go, Cam. Before we talk about this week's film, we need to introduce our very special guest making his second trip into the world of spy jinx. It is author and journalist Mr. Henry R. Schlesinger. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm fine.
Welcome back to the show. The last time you were here, we spoke about a much more straight down the middle, sensible spy story affair than we're talking about this week.
Right. This week, I'd like to talk about Red 2, which I believe is a much underrated film.
We'll certainly get to that. But I just want to just check with you, because obviously it's been a wee while since you've been on the show. What's been happening with you for the last year?
I've still been writing. I'm working on some new projects, both magazines and books, and hoping to get some things out there. I've done a couple of stories for Airmail News, an online venue.
Cool. And last time you were on the show, we sort of spoke about some of your favorite spy movies. So, has there been any sort of spy films you've watched in the last 12 months that have taken your fancy?
Not really. Nothing really exceptional, to tell you the truth. There have been some good, films out there, but I haven't really seen anything exceptional. I mostly go back to the classics, to tell you the truth.
Any rewatches that have popped out? Anything that's kind of come across your radar spy-wise where you've been kind of excited to see these movies?
No, some of the old Bonds or some of the older Bonds. I've rewatched Skyfall. I've rewatched No Time to Die. Spotted things in them that I liked. That kind of thing. Mostly I've been busy with work.
It's fair enough. I mean, I think you're echoing a sentiment a lot of our listeners have pointed out, as we have too, that the last year has not been the best when it comes to spy movie gifts. I'm looking at you, Ghosted and Argylle.
I haven't seen Argylle. I think I would have probably liked it better when it was Jewel of the Nile.
I don't know. I rewatched Jewel of the Nile fairly recently, and, you know, it's no Romancing the Stone.
Or Romancing the Stone. It seems to be the same thing. The movies that I'm actually looking forward to, I think it's on television. It's coming out. It's a new Guy Ritchie.
The Ungentlemanly Warfare, is that the one?
Right.
Yeah. They just dropped a trailer for that at time of recording a couple of days ago. It looks like a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm a huge Guy Ritchie fan. So I'm still waiting for the follow up to Rock and Roller.
I thought you were going to say the follow up to The Man from U.N.C.L.E., but I think the follow up to Rock and Roller is even less likely.
Much underrated film.
You said you wanted to come and talk about a particular film you just named, and I actually have a question for you about that, which we'll get to in a second, but let's cue it up. Drum roll, please. Cam, what are we talking about this week?
Yes, we are talking about 2013's Red 2, the sequel to Red.
Who would have known?
Right? Yeah, starring Bruce Willis and the whole gang.
The whole gang are back.
Right.
And if you've never seen Red 2, here is your synopsis. Red 2, the best, never rest.
Cute.
That was good. I like that. That was cute. Unlike the film.
Yeah, that's good marketing.
Yeah. Retired CIA agent Frank Moses reunites his unlikely team of elite operatives for a global quest to track down a missing portable nuclear device.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Short, straight to the punch. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that.
Right.
But I am curious because, you know, last time on the show, Henry, you were speaking about the Russia House with us. As I said, quite a lofty film.
Scott. Both literary adaptations.
Is Red 2 technically a literary adaptation? I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But, the reason I asked you to jump on this episode and we spoke about it originally is because you sort of put your hand up and said you were a fan of this film. And I was quite curious as to figure out why, which we'll get to what you think about the film in a minute. But I'm just curious as to, you know, why you were sort of on board with this film and why you wanted to speak about it.
I like what they did with it. What they do is they take all of the tropes of previous films, all the tropes of spy films, and they turn it and they turn them on their head and they play with these tropes. Many of the scenes in Red 2 can be transferred almost directly to a Jack Ryan or a Jason Bourne film. Mm-hmm. You've got car chases, you've got firearms, you've got femme fatales, and they're played straight, except for these comedic interludes, where sometimes there's comedy entered into it, you know, injected into the scene.
Yeah, like it has a light touch. It's not going the Austin Powers or Johnny English route.
Right. It has a light touch. In preparation for this interview or preparation for the podcast, I was thinking of films that are like that. And I know that I'm going to get hostile feedback for this.
I love it. Oh, please. Go on.
Go. Run with it.
The film that I came up with is Dr. Strangelove.
Perfect.
I can hear the bombs dropping on us now.
Yeah. Slim Pickens is riding in, waving his cowboy hat in the air.
Right. What they do is they take a serious subject and they inject humor into it. You could spend an afternoon and rewrite Strangelove as a serious drama. Mm-hmm. Taking out the jokes and taking out Terry Southern's pie fight, which was later taken out anyway.
Yeah.
You could spend the same afternoon or a different afternoon rewriting Red 2 as a serious spy movie, just taking out the jokes. And that's what makes it great, because it's played straight. It's not played broadly. The spy stuff is played straight. Hmm. There's a quote. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Spike Jonze, the composer, the band leader, not the director. The 1940s band leader.
Okay.
He made comedy recordings.
Did he work on Looney Tunes?
Yes, he did.
Okay. Yeah, that's why it was connecting in my brain. Yeah.
Right. And he made some propaganda movies. One was an anti-Nazi movie, which became very famous. But his son later said that what his father did wasn't easy. That if you take out a C-sharp note and put a pistol shot in, the pistol shot has to be C-sharp or it's not funny.
Mm.
And that's what Red 2 does. The one thing that they play on that's very interesting is the femme fatale scene or the relationship scene. In most spy movies, relationships are kind of tossed aside. Talking about them is tossed aside. It's a, you know, kiss, kiss, bang, bang kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
In Red 2 and the other Red movie, relationships are harped on. There's all of this self-help book kind of, advice that Frank Moses is given from different corners, you know, that plays very well, is inserted very well into the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I suppose before we dive too deep into Red 2, then, I'm curious about your original sort of Red connection. Were you a fan of the franchise when it first launched? Did you read the graphic novel, actually? I suppose is maybe a better way of getting into it.
I've glanced at the graphic novel since then.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Red is a good movie. I think that they really get their feet. They really, get going in Red 2. I think it's a superior movie, unfortunately. But you have to watch the first one, or you have to have some knowledge of the background, to really enjoy it.
Sure. Okay.
So it's a good double feature, Red and then Red 2.
Okay. So you were on board from the start. So you've sort of followed this Red train, as it were, through to two films. I mean, I already established, I sort of saw these around the time they came out. It was, I don't think I actually saw Red 2 until it came out on like home video. I don't think I was running to theaters to go and see Red 2, Cam.
I am in the exact same boat because I did go to theaters to see Red 1.
Mm-hmm.
And my memory was like, I walked out of the first Red being like, oh, that was pretty enjoyable. But for whatever reason, by the time Red 2 rolled around, I just was like, meh, I'm okay. And so I rented it at home or watched it on, streaming or something like that. I don't even remember how I saw it. But I also remember when I did see Red 2 that I was just kind of like indifferent.
Mm.
And my memories of the first one, which weren't spectacular when we went back to revisit it for the Christmas episode we did.
Yeah.
Were still much better than my memories of Red 2.
Huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to hold my cards close to my chest with Red 2. I'm going to wait until we get to the review part of it. But what I am curious about before we get any further into discussion on Red 2 and what we think of it is how we even got a sequel in the first place. Because from what I remember, the first one did okay, but it didn't do gangbusters. So how did we end up with a sequel, Cam?
It actually did quite well because the first Red did just a hair under 200 million worldwide on a relatively low budget of 58 million. So this is coming out of Summit, which is a company that makes kind of lower budgeted movies. They made the Twilight films, which mm-hmm. were obviously huge phenomenons. So they were looking for franchises and they were making other movies like that. You know, I think Drive Angry was an attempt also at kind of sparking something that didn't really work out.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like how to make kind of affordable franchise stuff that could pull in audiences. And so the first Red was for them a triumph. And it was like, okay, we can expand upon this. And the first Red came out October 2010. They announced in January 2011 that Red 2 was happening. So they were very quick off the success of Red to be like, no, round two, right away.
They weren't seeing any stop signs. It was all go.
Oh, perfect, Scott. Mm. And so they brought back the screenwriters, John and Eric Hober, who had mm-hmm. written the first film. And they'd gotten their start in the late 90s doing a Tarantino riff called Montana. And then had done, some things that maybe weren't so great, like the 2019 Whiteout comic book adaptation. But are guys who have since then gone on and done things like the Meg films, My Spy, and Transformers Rise of the Beasts. Just like studio go-to guys who know how to work in kind of that franchise world.
Sure.
And again, they were basing this very, very, very loosely off the graphic novel by Warren Ellis and Cully Hamner. That was a DC Wildstorm graphic novel series, much more stripped down, and really only, when we look at the first film, there's a few little connective points, mostly just character names.
Mm-hmm.
For Red 2, we are just looking at the barest of character names.
Which has happened a few times with these sort of pop culture translations from novels and graphic novels and things like that. I'm trying to think of anything off the top of my head, but the Bournes are a pretty good example, to be fair. A lot of the stories from the Bourne books are not actually featured in any of the films.
Yeah.
There's no Jackal, for instance.
Well, yeah, and exactly. And also when you look at some of those, The Spy Who Loved Me, there's a great example, right?
Yeah.
So that owes more to the movie You Only Live Twice than the book.
This is why the Richard Chamberlain 80s Bourne identity is a supreme identity.
There's no other Bourne in my world.
Ah.
And so the idea was to shoot Red 2 like immediately after Bruce Willis finished Die Hard 5, or as it would later be called, A Good Day to Die Hard. Terrific title. Terrific title. You got to give it that.
I don't know which one I prefer out of those two films.
And I was looking for a reason why the director of the first Red, Robert Schwenke, didn't come back. I couldn't find anything. Maybe he just wasn't interested in a sequel. Who knows? But it doesn't seem like it was ever a case of him being interested and then being forced out. It just, I don't know. Maybe he's not a sequel guy. So they went to Dean Parasot, who was a Connecticut-born director, won a 1988 Oscar for Best Live-Action Short for his second ever short, The Appointments of Dennis Jennings. And he'd co-written and directed that film. It starred Stephen Wright, who was a comedian, a very popular comedian, actually. He was the one who had the very deadpan voice. He's heard actually doing the radio segments in Reservoir Dogs.
That is not ringing any bells to me.
Okay. Well,
I'm sorry, but listeners, I'm sure, are like, hey, Scott, you're an idiot, as usual.
I don't know that he necessarily traveled across the pond. Like, Stephen Wright was very well known over on these shores, but I don't know.
Okay. That's fair.
He had very witty one-liners.
And the driest of dry delivery ever possible. Like, I don't think you can get more dry than Stephen Wright.
Is it, it's interesting because, I mean, the films that you named, the projects you named, I didn't ring any bells in my head. But is there anything else on his, like, CV that you could say might prompt my memory?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, there is, Scott. So he basically closed out the 80s and moved into the 90s directing television, worked on shows like Reading Rainbow, Get a Life, and Northern Exposure. And then in 1993, co-directed an anthology film called Two Mics Don't Make a Right. I'd never even heard of this. And he co-directed it with Michael Moore and Mike Lee, the director of such classics as like Topsy Turvy and Secrets and Lies. I was like, what is this movie? It has like a 2.9 on IMDb. I don't think anyone has ever watched this or liked it, but I was fascinated just to imagine those three people working together.
I can't picture that set. Mostly because I have no idea who this guy is. So that's definitely why I can't picture that set.
Oh, you do know who he is, Scott. You know this director very, very well.
Oh.
You've had several experiences with his work.
Oh.
So he moves into the late 90s. This is where he kind of makes his dent in Hollywood. He makes the Drew Barrymore film Home Fries. And that one was a modest hit. He follows that up with 1999's Galaxy Quest.
Oh.
Scott's eyes widen.
Uh-oh. A film I've seen far too many times.
Yeah. And Galaxy Quest, obviously not a big hit at the time, but has since become a huge cult classic. And Scott, you and I have watched it now twice at the Las Vegas Star Trek convention together.
Yeah, once by the pool.
Yeah, that's right. Not in the pool, but by the pool.
No, I was in the pool.
Were you in the pool that time?
I was.
I was in the pool for 2009, the Star Trek 2009.
No one else was. I was like, come in. Everyone's like, no, why are you in the pool, Scott?
Yeah, so Galaxy Quest is a real hallmark on his filmography.
Okay.
And he does a lot of TV. He does like the pilot for the TV show Monk, for example.
Yeah.
In terms of movies, he did the Jim Carrey Fun with Dick and Jane remake. And this, you know, he pretty much rolled into after doing a string of TV jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Going forward, he really just works in TV. His last theatrical film was Bill and Ted Face the Music, which was released during the pandemic.
Mm.
But was a fun, you know, follow-up to those original Bill and Ted films.
That was a nice nostalgia trip of a film.
Yeah. Totally.
I think it got lost in the sort of COVID shuffle, unfortunately. Probably would have found more fans if it had come out like a normal film in cinemas.
I mean, I'm sure its box office is like $500,000 because, yeah, it was released during the kind of the worst period of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I watched it at home when it hit streaming.
Same.
They did the, yeah, kind of, I think they did a day and date for like $19.99, and I waited till the price dropped a bit and watched it.
I think originally it was actually meant to be released here on paid VOD, and then it was pulled. So you had to wait a while in the UK, and then eventually I watched it. When I think it's on like Netflix now.
Yeah, yeah, it's readily available now, but initially they were trying to find a way to make it economically, lucrative.
I just can't get over the fact the guy that made Galaxy Quest also made this film, because I love Galaxy Quest.
Oh, geez, Scott, you're really tipping your hand here. So also in the trades, an interesting thing was that Anthony Hopkins was announced as the villain in headlines in the trades.
Okay. So the twist was spoiled.
That's right. Mm. That's right. It's a little bit like the Argyle twist that was completely given away early on in the trades.
I love
and
that.
Then people picked up on it later. Mm. Yeah.
If you didn't know, folks, by the way, the whole like Argyle twist, I'm not going to spoil that for you because if you haven't seen the film, but there's a big twist midway through the film. And they were like, hashtag, don't let the cat out of the bag, all that sort of stuff. But if you go back a couple of years, there's a tweet from Variety saying, X to play villain in new spy film from Matthew Vaughn. I was like, oh, it's been there the whole time, hidden in plain sight.
Yeah, they completely just spoiled the entire thing in that Variety story. It's kind of amazing. And they did the same thing here. And apparently Anthony Hopkins was actually kind of up in the air. They had to figure out a way to work him around Thor the Dark World. Now, as I recall, in Thor the Dark World, his character's in a coma for most of the movie, so I suspect it wasn't that hard.
I mean, I spent most of this film in the same position.
Oh, Scott, jeez, this is cold. It's like a drive-by shooting going on here.
There's a nice Easter egg. Maybe that will get your attention for Red 2.
Okay. Go on.
There's a throwaway scene in which Helen Mirren, playing Victoria, feigns madness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To get into the psychiatric ward. And she pretends to be Elizabeth.
Yeah.
The first. And she's got the red hair and all of that. And at one point she screams, get me Cecil, which seems to come out of nowhere, except if you study spy history. And Cecil was William Cecil, her advisor and sometimes spy master.
Now, Scott, that one jumped out to you, obviously. I can tell from your expression.
It's all of my notes is Cecil notes. It's all I have to say. Yeah.
Cecil Hards.
Welcome aboard, folks.
But, you know, she does a great Aunt Mad Elizabeth, I guess. You know, give her that.
I've got good things to say about this film. Don't get me wrong. I've just got some bad things to say, too. I thought when you said Easter eggs, you were going to mention the Stephen Burkhoff cameo. Now, that got my attention for about 5 seconds.
Okay. Speaking of character actors that are very recognizable, Ernest Borgnine, who had a role in the first film.
Yeah.
Actually became very close friends with the writers, the Hobers. And they would hang out, they would go to lunch, and Ernest Borgnine really wanted to come back for Red 2 and said, you know, can I have an action scene in this movie? And so they actually wrote a huge section of the opening was all built around his character, and then he passed away. So they had to revise the entire opening of the movie. But originally, Ernest Borgnine would have factored into the whole opening of the movie.
He was running around a Costco?
Not that part, but from what I understand, all the Titus Welliver stuff, information, would have been handled by the Ernest Borgnine character in a different form, but that information would have come through him.
Okay, I can see that, yeah.
Yeah, because when Titus Welliver pops up, you're like, is this all he does in this movie? Like, it's kind of a weird insertion, whereas if Ernest Borgnine had done that kind of material, you can understand organically how that would make sense.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, I'm just always happy just to say the name Ernest Borgnine.
Who is it?
Sounds great.
That's right. And so we said the budget for the first one was $58 million. The budget for Red 2 was $84 million. So there was a boost, and I suspect that was actually getting a lot of the cast back and having to pay for sequel pay. Mm-hmm. So $84 million. Domestically, it did $53.3 million. So not great. The first one did 90.3, so it was $40 million less in North America. International was similar. It did 94.8 international as compared to 108.6 international for the first, for a worldwide total of $148.1 million for Red 2. So that's again 148.1. The first one did 199, so it was basically a $50 million drop off for Red 2.
And you want growth from your films, not a reduction. So they, I imagine some people in offices at least saw this as a failure.
Well, if you go and watch interviews for Red 2, which I did watch several, it's not even a secret that they want to make Red 3. Everyone is basically like, yeah, we're making Red 3. There will be a Red 3. And the fact that everyone was so gung-ho about it, it's very telling that you then look at that box office and it makes a little bit of sense as to why there was no Red 3.
Yeah, because I could definitely see a Red 3 coming out in 2015, 2016.
Yep, and I'll get to that in a second. So Red 2 landed at number 52 for the year between the Keanu Reeves film 47 Ronin, which I don't think anyone remembers, and the Jessica Chastain film Mama, which was pretty well regarded at the time. I've never seen it, but it was a horror film. The top three for the year, number one was Frozen, number two was Iron Man 3, and number three was Despicable Me 2, a movie that we may cover on Spy Hards one day.
No.
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 No. No. And as I mentioned, Red 3. So before they even released Red 2, Summit announced that the Hobers would be writing Red 3, and they would be starting in January 2014. So just a few months really after Red 2 was coming out. And that obviously just kind of trailed off. Nothing was ever spoken about since. They did announce in 2015 that NBC would be making a TV series based around Red from the same writers, the Hobers. And that also was a very quiet, just kind of dissipation into the air.
Great word.
Thank you.
It does look as if the cast is having fun, Bruno and the rest of them.
Yeah, and when you go and watch interviews, it seems like people had fun. It's tough, honestly, to Google interviews for this because there was a very uncomfortable Bruce Willis interview that came out of the Red 2 circuit. And if you Google now Red 2 interview, you just get that for like blanketed across the internet. It was one that now we maybe look at a little differently, that Bruce Willis may not have been in necessarily the best of straits that day.
Right.
But it was a interview with a British journalist, and it's at the time was labeled as Bruce rude to journalist, and that just became like clickbait. But it's now just like pasted across the entire history of Red 2 interviews when you Google it.
That's a damn shame.
Yeah, yeah. And just lastly, we like to talk about awards sometimes. Red 2 was nominated for the 2014 People's Choice Award for Favorite Thriller Movie. And I am going to name the other nominees, and let's see if you guys can guess the winner of the People's Choice Award. Can you get inside the mind of the people?
Often not.
So we got Red 2. We've got A Good Day to Die Hard, The Call, which was a Halle Berry thriller from the time, if you've forgotten it. Mm-hmm. White House Down, the White House thriller that Roland Emmerich made.
Yeah.
And Now You See Me, the magic thriller.
Wait. Now You See Me... It didn't have a colon, the magic thriller afterwards, did it? You added that, right?
I added that. That's descriptive.
It's an alternate title I do not want in my life.
The magic thriller? I don't know. Now You See Me, the magic thriller is a better title than Now You See Me 2.
Oh, don't get me started on that train. Okay, so we're going to figure out who was the best thriller of 2013.
Who did the people champion? I would say, just an aside, not a great year for thrillers.
Not from the list you just said. Henry, I want to hear from you first.
I'm going to go with the magic thriller, Now You See Me.
No, okay. We're just going to call it the magic thriller from now on.
Magic thriller.
The unnamed film, the magic thriller. Okay, I don't want to go for the same one because it's more fun that way. I mildly enjoyed White House Down, so I'm going to go for that.
Okay, Henry nailed it. It was Now You See Me, which makes sense. I think it was the biggest hit of the group of them.
Sure.
But, you know, those are the people. The people have spoken.
Tricks are for kids, Cam. Well, there you go. There you go. Well, it's been an interesting lead up coming from Red 1 to Red 2. We're here to talk about Red 2 Electric Boogaloo. Let's get down to it. Henry, you've championed this film. You've wanted to come on and talk about it. Here is your moment in the spotlight. What do you think of Red 2?
I think it's a great movie that takes all of the old Hollywood tropes and pokes fun at them. You've got femme fatales, firearms, fast cars, all of the things that, you know, go at the heart of a lot of these very serious, humorless movies, and it pokes fun at them. There's a scene, another Easter egg or another throwaway scene, when Helen Mirren, Victoria, gets into a sports car when they're escaping the Iranian embassy.
Yeah.
She calls it, "Can you drive this ridiculous thing?" The sports car isn't admired, it's seen as an oddity. Or it's seen as something silly in the spy world.
Yeah.
There's another sports car, a Porsche, that's used in another chase scene when they're chasing the Frenchman, the frog. And, Bruce Willis hops in it, action adventure style, to, pursue this guy on a motorcycle. And his, John Malkovich and Bruno's girlfriend are in a little Peugeot of some kind, mm-hmm. Pursuing in the same kind of car chase. So they take a lot of these tropes and they turn them on their head. Even the ancient wheeze of the everyman being, being called to duty, which Jack Ryan style, where he's just this ordinary guy who's got to do this stuff, and the movie begins in Costco. He's just this Costco shopping guy who, is right in international intrigue, is thrust into international intrigue. It's fun the way they, you can see them. They take one trope after another, one cliche after another, and play off it in a very humorous way. They set him up and knock him down, as it were.
Yeah, and actually, when you were saying an Easter egg, also the whole Bruce Willis getting into the car as the car spins around and he jumps inside is actually a reversal of a moment from the first Red. So it's kind of an Easter egg for fans of that franchise as well, in that Bruce Willis jumps out of the car in the first one and jumps into the car in the second one. So I thought that was actually a fun little moment too.
Yeah, it's if you take your spy movies very seriously, you're not going to enjoy it. But if you take them as, entertainments, if you look at them as entertainments, it's a lot of fun finding the cliches, the spy movie cliches that they, play with. Even conspiracy theories.
Sure.
They play with a lot of the, current or, old conspiracy theories. Like MK Ultra and that kind of thing.
I mean, I'll throw it to Cam in a second, but I want to jump on something first you mentioned. And firstly, I mean, much as it's Peugeot, I now will be pronouncing it as Peugeot because I think that's actually a better way of pronouncing that manufacturer of car.
Okay.
You've nailed that. Like, everyone should change it to Peugeot going forward. It actually sounds classier somehow. You've nailed that. I agree on many parts. I think, it's winking at the genre, but in a loving way, as opposed to sort of sticking your middle finger up the at, not up, the franchise.
Oh, wow. Ooh. Scott.
Oh, my.
Pull up.
It got
up.
Very red all of a sudden.
And blue.
But yes, I always think about something like Spy Kids, the first Spy Kids film.
Mm.
That was made by Robert Rodriguez as a love letter to spy movies. And I think the first Red film definitely felt the same way. I've got mixed feelings on the sequel, but I know that the Hober brothers, I believe that's their name, definitely had a lot of love for this genre.
Yeah, and they clearly are the visionaries of this franchise,
mm-hmm.
because the directors are changing. You can tell that they are very much the ones guiding the tone, and obviously we're going to oversee a TV show and Red 3 as well, so it's kind of like their little universe.
I guess you couldn't call it Red TV. People would think it was something else.
That is accurate. Mm. Yes.
Yeah. Can't let my kids watch Red TV. Cam, people are already getting a sense of how I feel about it, so I'm going to put myself at the other side of this sandwich. Why don't you be the meaty filling?
I think I fall somewhere in the middle, in that I think this movie's pretty much on par with the original Red.
Sure.
And the original Red is not a movie that I do backflips over. I think it's enjoyable enough, and I felt the same way with this one, in that this movie has some weaknesses the first one doesn't have,
mm-hmm.
but I think also has strengths the first one doesn't have. So I think there's actually a total balance in terms of kind of evening each other out, because I think this movie has a much better grasp on tone than the first one did, which I felt, and I remember we talked about that, how it would kind of flip-flop sometimes between very broad mm-hmm. comedic moments to like moments that kind of were a little heavy in a way that felt awkward. I didn't feel that at all in this movie. I felt like it had a better sense as to what a Red movie is and how to deliver one. I think it also figures out the Mary Louise Parker character much better, who often felt adrift in the first movie and would often just disappear. I think there's a very well-baked-in kind of through line for her character. Yes, it's kind of built around a, you know, female jealousy subplot that gets a little cliche, I think. But beyond that, they find a reason why her character is invaluable to what's going on in the story. And I think they didn't quite crack that in the first one.
Well, it's a natural progression of her character from the last one, because she was a bored at home, down on her luck, dating life was terrible, didn't like what she was doing as a job. And this ex-spy turns up and whisks her on a globe-trotting adventure. She's shown this life of excitement and has a taste for it. So, of course, she wants more.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's kind of following the, you know, we mentioned them earlier, Romancing the Stone, Jewel of the Nile kind of concept, right?
Mm-hmm.
But whereas it felt like Kathleen Turner is integral to what's going on in Romancing the Stone, Mary Louise Parker often got kind of pushed into the back seat for the first read, whereas here I think feels much more vital. And I think for me, though, where this one falls short of the first one is more in terms of there's a lot of emphasis on plot, and I think it kind of bogs the movie down in terms of its energy by the time you get to the end. Like, I don't know that I would have aimed for this movie to be 2 hours. I think if you cut it down a little and made it a little faster paced, it might have clicked with me a little more. But ultimately, I can't say that Red 2 is a step down in my eyes from Red 1 that much.
No, I completely agree on some points you made there, Cam. I think I think what they do with Mary Louise Parker is actually a decent progression from where she is before, which is it's actually quite good to say, because I could see a different film treating her as just a side character that you just put away and you get back to your spies.
Also, it's Hollywood. So, like, suddenly Catherine Zeta-Jones walks in and they're like, give her most of the screen time. That is such a common thing as well, especially for female characters.
I mean, they do the whole jealous girlfriend thing, which I don't like too much.
One of the best scenes.
What's that? The jealous girlfriend part?
Yeah, when she walks out of the hotel in the new outfit.
Oh, and, sure. Yeah.
And says, you know, we're in Paris. You're supposed to spend your boyfriend's money. When, you know, he gets taken down by a Russian bitch. You know, that's hysterical.
Well, I think we're actually let's do it. It looks like me and Henry are different sides of the sandwich. I'm going to get to what I think about Red 2, because I've been pulling my punches. I'm going to go in
Have you?
For Haymaker. Well,
Have
no,
you?
Not really. Well, I've okay. Maybe I've been colouring it the whole time. Who knows? I found it really hard to care about this sequel. I felt like they had nothing to say.
Mm.
It felt like it was people talk about in Hollywood where you have like a sequel because you need to rush a sequel out because the film was so good. But what story are we telling? We don't know. Just get a sequel out quickly. We need money. And this film for me just reeked of that problem. I felt like they had nothing to say about the characters and no story to tell. So the problem I found is, much as I enjoyed seeing John Malkovich running around being a lunatic, Helen Mirren just being Helen Mirren, some really fun stuff that I enjoyed in the first one turned up to 11 in the sequel. All fun to see. I think there was nothing here to talk about. There is no plot that I'll ever remember. I think there is too many villains that lose itself in that. It gets all muddy. You don't know who I'm supposed to be focusing on. And it forgets to talk about it for a long amount of time. You know, Catherine Zeta-Jones is a villain for a little while. Neil McDonough is a villain for a little while. A couple of other stuffy British guys are villains for a little while. And you don't really get to sort of a genesis until you get the big heel turn from Anthony Hopkins, which was, of course, spoiled online. But
not that we remembered.
But that's by the by. I just don't think there was a focus. It lacked focus. But suffice to say, I just didn't enjoy myself, which is one thing I really did in the first one. I just, like, it was a turn your brain off, just enjoy the spy action adventure, don't think about it too much. And so I was just there watching the sort of sequences and enjoying the characters. And this film has characters that I enjoy, has a couple of action sequences that I enjoy, but I just don't think it's like a part two to the first story. It doesn't have anything to add to it. It's like a epilogue to the first film. There are no new ideas here, and I just was just really disappointed.
I think that's part of its charm. It's a very generic spy plot.
Yeah,
put that on the DVD case.
No, the spy plot is very generic, and that gives the actors a little room to play in, or that gives the screenwriters a little room to play in. You know, exploring these tropes, turning the cliches on their head. You don't have to think too much about the plot.
Sure.
You're not worried about whether the nuclear device is going to go off and, you know, that kind of thing. But it, you know, it's just fun to watch these, usually taken very seriously plot points, played with. The scene where Bruce Willis is drugged and brought back to the hotel room,
Yeah.
She keeps slapping him,
Right.
and you can tell that, she goes from trying to wake him up to retribution. I thought that was hysterical. Or where she go, where she goes out shopping and, delivers this little monologue as she gets into the taxi. I thought that was, funny.
But what I love, what I hear from you there, Henry, is all the stuff you're loving is the Mary Louise Parker's character's actions, which is a step up from the first one. I've got to say, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Her character, grew in the second one. She does more things other than being afraid, or she's acclimated to the world of espionage.
Yeah.
Well, I love how she sees Catherine Zeta-Jones, who's kind of this seductress type of character, and she has her own
Femme fatale.
approach. Yeah, femme fatale. She has her own approach to getting information that we see through her. It's like this very almost like loving, sensitive
Yeah.
kind of femme fatale approach that
Yeah.
really works for her. And I like that it's not her looking at Catherine Zeta-Jones and being like, how do I do the exact same thing and try to be better?
Yeah.
She has her own unique, quirky approach that feels driven by her character, not by trying to copycat.
Right. Even the John Malkovich character grows a little bit. I think they all, hit a stride in the second one that they didn't in the first. They understood the characters better. The writers understood the characters better, and they got to play more, if that makes sense.
Sure. Well, let's pivot over to things that we liked about the film more specifically. Henry, I'll put you on the spot. Do you want to call out a certain moment or a part of the film, a thematic part of the film that you really enjoyed about Red 2?
I really enjoyed the way it hung together, that the way all of the cliches turned on their head hung together, and worked. They were It worked as comedy, and it also worked to forward the plot. I thought they did that really well. Like the seduction of the frog.
Sure. A sentence that hasn't been said on the show before.
Right. It was it was it was funny, and it was, something you don't see in spy movies, but it worked. It forwarded the plot. It moved the plot forward. And I think that the writers, felt less constricted in the second one, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it felt like, I mean, I mentioned kind of the tone feeling a little kind of all over the place in the first one. It felt like the writers and the director Dean Parasot, directing this movie, had a much more clear idea as to what a Red movie was, whereas I felt in the first one they were trying to find it a bit.
Yeah.
Well, there's sort of an irreverence, a tonal irreverence, I think, for it. And it's sort of like these are all old people in air quotes, but they're still super active. And it makes jokes about them being old, but it doesn't really like portray them as inadequate in any way, which I quite like.
But also, like John Malkovich, we mentioned him a moment ago. His character is like really Looney Tunes in the first movie. Like he has very, very, very broad comedy stuff, whereas I felt like he was a little more honed down in this movie. And I don't know if that was because they wanted Anthony Hopkins to be the bigger personality, the kind of the goofier one in the movie. But it felt like Malkovich, they were like, try to bring in a little more reality than the first movie.
I mean, he has his moments. I think that his final shot is him in a full like flamenco outfit with fruit on his head, if I remember correctly.
And
Oh, I didn't see, Cam. That's what you're wearing right now.
I mean, I don't know. When I see like him running around with like the stuffed pig in the first movie,
Sure.
they're like, that's wacky. But it's Anthony Hopkins that's carrying the stuffed pig in this movie. So it's almost like them acknowledging that he's the more outlandish character in this, in the world of Red 2.
Yeah, well, he's certainly very kooky.
He is incredibly kooky, especially when he first shows up.
Always nice to see Anthony Hopkins in a cell.
That's true. Yeah. You can't go wrong, really.
It writes itself.
That was the problem with Hannibal, was he wasn't in a cell for that movie.
That's how you fix it. But well, there you go. That's a good opener there. Cam, I'd like from you.
I actually really enjoyed Lee Byung-hun in this movie, an actor who I feel has never, they've never cracked what to do with him because he's such an incredible physical performer. And I felt like Dean Parasot did a really good job shooting the action scenes. I'm not sure if it was him or the second unit person, but like when you have that scene of Byung-hun with like the door of the cooler, like that he's holding on to, taking down an entire army of people.
Yeah.
The physical grace and the willingness to kind of step back and just show his like ballet like martial arts skills.
Mm-hmm.
That's exciting to me. It's not chopped to ribbons. I can get a clear sense as to how good he is. But I also thought he's really quirky and funny in this movie. I think on paper, you could easily look at that character and just be like, they're just replicating Carl Urban. And I did have a bit of that sense initially when they set up that character again, because it's, again, it's this the best of the best, you know, assets that is being sent towards our heroes that has a pivot point at a certain point in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought like they made that character, the Han character, kind of odd, kind of unusual. And you had an actor who got to showcase not only the martial arts, but like the dramatic side he could pull off. You know, you get the intensity of the character, but also the comedy. And, you know, when I look at, you know, Lee Byung-hun, I think of what is he known for? He played Storm Shadow in the first G.I. Joe movie. He was one of the Terminators, one of the bad Terminators in Terminator Genesis. These are not great films. And I just don't think North American films have known how to use him very well. He's very, very strong, you know, back, you know, in his foreign films he makes. But in terms of North American movies, ugh, I think Red 2 might be the best showcase I've seen for him.
He did get the comedy down.
He was great, yeah.
He does it in one line in the very beginning of the movie, where he goes in to assassinate the warlord or whatever he is, the crime lord. And he has to take off all of his clothes. He goes, really?
Yeah, I mean, if you go back and watch his like South Korean films, movies like I Saw the Devil or The Good, the Bad, and the Weird, like this man is like a movie star. He's incredible. And I just think he's been so underserved in American films. And I'm not saying Red 2 is the one he should be carving on his, you know, necessarily career achievement award when he gets to the end of it. But like, it's nice to see people who recognize his value on screen as opposed to kind of just give him a one-note action role.
Do you think he was imitating Jackie Chan?
In
some of the martial arts scenes?
Like, do you mean like using the everyday objects and everything like that?
Yeah.
In as much as I think he's trying to work in some comedic moments, like comedic beats, that's something Jackie Chan very much specializes in. It's not all brutality or just aggressive martial arts. It's like kind of walking that line between action and comedy. I would say there are some little moments there, yeah.
I do agree about the sort of hand character. I do have one issue. I'm going to rain on your parade a little bit there, Cam, if you don't mind.
Go for it. Rain away. I am Gene Kelly dancing under it.
You're going to need to. He specifies that he... Actually, Bruce Willis specifies that he was teaching him during the Cold War. Now, the actor that you're talking about, I did some quick math. And don't get me wrong, I only got a C in maths in school, but Lee Byung-hun was born in 1970. So if he was active during the Cold War, which ended around the late 80s, he was doing it as an underage soldier or a conscript of some sort, perhaps, but I don't think the timelines add up.
I'm willing to add a couple years to his age if it works.
Okay. All right. Apparently, I've got a bee in my bonnet about this film. I'm just like, I'm poo-pooing everyone today. I'm raining. I am raining on parades. I'm a parade rainer.
The number of movies we've seen where it's like aging action stars playing like 40-year-olds, and we're like, eh, it's fine. But you're really calling this one out.
Well, but I will give you a like.
I can't wait to get to our View to a Kill episode where you've got the entire MI6 team is over 60.
Oh, a woman. Oh.
Yeah.
There are two things I want to call out as likes, I think, because I'm the last one on the list, so I'll throw in a couple of extras. Firstly, I think it's absolutely great that Catherine Zeta-Jones thinks that bald men are sexy and virile.
Oh, jeez.
I needed that confidence boost today. Thank you, Catherine Zeta-Jones. And I desperately needed it. And secondly, I just was so happy to see Helen Mirren and John Malkovich just letting loose. You know, they both have been in very stuffy roles in the past. And I know it's a lot of the same what happened in Red 1, turned up to 11, as I said earlier, but I just love seeing them in these sort of slightly comedic roles.
Well, maybe let's break them down and just start with, like, Catherine Zeta-Jones, who sports a Carmen Sandiego hat like nobody's business.
She does.
Like, adding her to this movie, I thought made a lot of sense. She fits in well in that world. Wasn't she in Ocean's 12 with Bruce Willis? I think she was. I can't remember which movie she got added to the team. I think it was Ocean's 12. But she just is such a natural, like, comedian. And she's also very good dramatically. And so to have her playing this character who's walking just that line of the absurd, I thought she was perfect.
It was Ocean's 12.
Okay, perfect, yeah.
Yeah, I think she was great. I thought they would end up introducing more characters into this sort of cavalcade of retired and extremely dangerous operatives. You don't really get that many more. Because I thought they'd go down more like the Expendables route and add in a bunch of just your favorite icons from the, you know, 80s or 70s or whatever.
Yeah.
Or people that are playing against type, which is kind of what this series is known for more than Expendables is. But yeah, I think Catherine Zeta-Jones is probably the best addition to the team.
You could almost see them adding her husband, Michael Douglas. Like, he would have blended in well in this world, even. Like, because it surprised me a little too, because you had Morgan Freeman's character died in the first one, that you think they might feel more of that compulsion to inject multiple other actors they could market in their trailers. But it really is just Anthony Hopkins is kind of the big aging star, and Catherine Zeta-Jones was not that old at that point. So,
Who plays the oligarch? The KGB officer turned oligarch.
Is that Brian Cox?
I don't know. He didn't have very many scenes, but he was just terrific.
Are we talking about the guy who has a built-in foot fetish?
Yes.
That would be Mr. Brian Cox.
Okay.
Headline for the episode: Brian Cox, foot fetish found. Quentin Tarantino, secret director?
Well, he was such a fun part of the first movie because you had the romantic connection with him and Helen Mirren. I wonder if Brian Cox was busy shooting something else for Red 2 because his character is pretty minor in terms of screen time here.
No, but he does just a terrific job. You know, giving them the suicide pills, which is another trope. Spotting for Helen Mirren when she's shooting, you know, and then the goodbye at the plane when they're going to meet at Turk and Caicos, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, I think he wasn't in often, but he did a very good job in it. I thought it was just, you know.
Has Brian Cox ever been bad? I mean, he was amazing as like the host of 007 Road to a Million. And if ever there's a job you could phone in, it's that one.
You're not wrong. And I mean, I'm a big fan of Succession, the recent series that ended. Great show. Check it out, folks, if you haven't already. But I will answer your question, Cam, about what he was doing in the year this came out. And it was a very busy year for Brian Cox. He released the following things in 2013.
Okay.
When it comes to TV, you have the following. You have 6 episodes of Bob Servant Independent, whatever that is. 5 episodes of MI High. You have 1 episode of Tombed, 3 episodes of Shetland.
Okay.
2 TV movies, 1 An Adventure in Space and Time and The Curse of Edgar. And then 5 feature films.
What?
Yep, 5 feature films. Red 2, Blumenthal, Believe, Mindscape, and Her.
Okay, Her is great. And the rest of those movies, Red 2 obviously we're talking about, but the rest of those movies are not exactly ones that made a real blip on the old radar.
I just think he was taking any job going, and he's like, yeah, I'll do it.
Yeah, it was like his Michael Caine phase.
Yeah. He hadn't had Succession yet. He was building to his comeback.
Yeah. Coming off that Rise of the Planet of the Apes high, too.
And now he's doing a real sort of Dakota Johnson in Madam Web and signing up to the 007 series thinking it was a movie.
Yeah, no kidding.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special report.
Red Alert, Spyhards, we are shaking things up over on the Patreon page.
That's right, we are launching an exclusive new show where we tackle the exploits of the small screen's greatest secret agents, like Jack Bauer, George Smiley, and beyond.
And don't forget, every month you also get two Agents in the Field episodes where we decode the adventures of your favorite spy actors in their biggest non-spy movies. But Cam, tell the people what we have coming up next.
Scott and I are going to be switching identities because we are going to tackle the 1997 John Woo action extravaganza Face Off, starring John Travolta and Nicolas Cage. We are ready. Ready for the big ride, baby.
So don't get left out in the cold. Help support your favorite spy movie podcast and join the circus at patreon.com/spyhards. But before this message self-destructs, let's get back to the spy jinx. Well, let's be the Da Vinci's of death and talk a little bit about the bad side of Red 2. Dislikes, there's got to be something out there, Henry. Let us know. Something you didn't quite like about Red 2.
I didn't like that Morgan Freeman wasn't in it.
You could have done it. You could have had that whole bait and switch and he survived somehow.
Yeah. And I really thought that some of the ancillary characters could have had more time.
Yeah, I felt that way as well. I wonder how much of that was just scheduling. Of like getting these actors in for a couple days to make them all work, because a lot of these people were busy. And yeah, I just wonder how much, I mean, I don't know that Red 2 has as much clout as if you're making, I don't know, the latest James Cameron film for locking down people's schedules. Mm-hmm. And so it felt like some of them were kind of just, you know, shoot their material in a couple weeks or whatever and get them out of there.
And I thought they could have done more in Russia, to tell you the truth, more in Moscow.
It felt like they were barely there. I think a lot of it was set-based or green-screened in. There was a couple of shots of like Bruce Willis and Mary Louise Parker walking that felt very much like it was just green-screened background in. They shot a plate and then just put it on behind them.
Well, they never went to Moscow. They shot in London and Paris. So those locations, they were there. And then most of it was done in Quebec, in Canada. So they were using a lot of fakery there. Even some of the London scenes were done in Quebec.
Quebec?
Really?
The St. Petersburg of Canada.
Well, all the U.S. locations, I think, are in Quebec.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I've never been to Quebec. I hear it's lovely. Actually, that's not true. I did have a stopover for about an hour and a half when I was flying, so I guess I have been in Quebec.
And you were like, wow, this looks just like Russia.
I went and I ordered a Montreal smoked sandwich, and that was that.
What a story. I'm glad we all got that from Cam.
I'm here to deliver every week, folks.
Just like Red 2. Oh, we're all happy with it. Cam, what about you? A dislike?
Okay, so I'm just going to toss out a quick one, which is the product placement in this movie is really embarrassing.
Oh, boy.
The Papa John's pizza visit. I was like, oh, my God. Sure thing. And yeah, and then there's the Pringles moment. The Pringles one at least is a little more fun because it's actually a spy tactic.
It's worked into the, like, the, it's actually a plot element in a way.
Yeah, so I can like overlook that one, but the Papa John stuff was pretty embarrassing. But that's not my major dislike. I think for me it is that like plot focus where we are expected to spend so much time kind of following the Anthony Hopkins plot, and it, to me, and it's cool that like, yeah, Henry, it works for you. For me, where I found it frustrating was we'd set up, and Scott mentioned this earlier, multiple villains. We had Neil McDonough as this like murderous government asset. We've got Lee Byung-hun's character, Han. We have various other interests. And they all just wind up taking this back seat, which can work. A twist can work. But to me, it just felt like I was building up interesting personalities or at least having interesting character actors that just didn't get much to do.
It's interesting. It has that sort of problem that I would say, oh, well, this isn't a first, by the way, but a lot of people have said about The Living Daylights.
Oh, yeah.
There's just too many villains and no coherent sort of one person you can focus the story around, and it just makes the plot feel muddy because there is no central focus. There's no central drive for our characters. They are doing something, but they're often just talking about what they're doing. There's no antagonist propelling them forward and they're trying to keep up or anything like that. It's more just a lot of machinations happening in other places for a lot of this film until it all comes together. You see, like, Neil McDonough is just going around interrogating people in the background. It's not really felt by our characters. They know they have to keep moving somehow because the plot tells us that, but there is no, there's no actual feeling of pressure because you're not seeing them being thwarted time after time.
I would have liked to have seen more spy gadgets, I think.
Right. Yeah, there's not a lot of gadget stuff.
There's a lot of MacGyvering.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Helen Mirren pulls the pick out of her, you know, from under a fake skin. The Pringles package, that kind of thing. So there's some MacGyvering, but there's not a lot of spy gadgets.
You do get the old classic in the heel of the shoe poison thing, or whatever, that you'd store stuff in there.
Right.
And Malkovich's phone. That's another one.
Well, that looked, that's a MacGyvering thing. He looks like he has three phones put together, each going to a different, location, dialing into a different location.
Right. And I want to just bounce back to McDonough's character for a second, because, like, he's set up as, like, kind of an interesting character, where it's someone who has the sort of government, like, okayed ability to do whatever he wants.
Like an oversight to just do a carte blanche, a license to kill, if you will.
Yeah, like, he murders a general, like, at the Pentagon. And so, like, that's kind of interesting to me. And the way they have him as, like, this very, very deadly adversary, I thought was interesting. And I get they want to subvert that, because you have Anthony Hopkins revealed as the true monster, who has this red mercury, or whatever, this untraceable red mercury bomb. But you have the moment where Anthony Hopkins releases the nerve agent and kills, like, a whole bunch of these people who've been players in the movie as antagonists. But he keeps Neil McDonough alive. And you're like, this is going to pay off big. And I never felt like the reason for keeping him alive paid off in an interesting way. So I then was like, oh, not only did I feel cheated initially when I thought that was how Neil McDonough went out, then we really didn't do anything with him after that either. That I found frustrating.
I think that he's another trope, though. The rogue CIA agent or the rogue intelligence officer, again, that's another trope, that they play with.
I feel like, though, when you have the asset that Lee Byung-hun plays, like, that is a total trope. That is the born asset character we've seen a billion times. But they're like, how do we play with that? How do we make him kind of quirky and neurotic and odd? And that works. Whereas, like, Neil McDonough, I don't know that they ever find a twist on that type of trope where I go, oh, that's clever.
Well, he feels like he's in a bit of a different film. I mean, whenever I see Neil McDonough, and I've got some long-standing issues with the guy, not personally, he doesn't know who I am. I'm not banned from near his neighborhood. No, not at all. And I'll leave those to us. If you want to ask me about those, feel free to write us an email. But he feels like he's in a film with Eric Roberts, that sort of film. That sort of B, maybe a C movie, really low budget sort of schlock. And his story never really seems to tie in for me. And so he's just dispatched by Anthony Hopkins. I'm kind of glad in a way. But there is a nugget of interesting, like you say, Cam. Like, he does kill that guy in the Pentagon. It's interesting that they do that, but then really don't pay off the character at all. I wonder if there was something they wanted to do, couldn't do for time. Like you say, it was a time problem. But then again, I think, is Neil McDonough busy?
No, I don't think that's an issue with scheduling.
No.
If anything, Anthony Hopkins is the issue with scheduling.
Yeah, that does sound right. And I'm gonna spin that off into my dislike. And we've tackled a lot of them. I've already made jokes about a lot of my dislikes, or I've commented on them. But I think one of the most damning things about Red 2 is, unlike Red 1, where there are moments that I actually can recall, and this being the second time that I've watched it, I still don't think I could recall any particular sequence from it. I don't think it has a memorable standout moment. The first film's got Bruce Willis coming out of the car. You've got John Malkovich running around with an RPG, or him with, like, the bomb on his chest, like the massive clock looking like his MC, whatever that is. But this one didn't seem to have those moments for me that, like you'd say, trailer worthy almost.
Helen Mirren shooting two guns in a sports car.
Set to Linkin Park.
Was it Linkin Park? I thought I recognized that hook.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Helen Mirren, Linkin Park fan. Not a sentence I thought I'd ever say.
I was, like, bursting out laughing. I'm like, this is the most, like, 2013 thing I think you could ever do.
What I've done is make a bad film. Well, if that's your standout moment, then I sit corrected. But I'd be interested to hear what you all think at home. Is there standout moments? Am I missing it? Am I not connecting to it? I don't know. But for me, I feel like it's just one of those sequels that's made to make a sequel, and there wasn't a lot of heart.
I'm trying to think of those sequences, because I do think the finale with Anthony Hopkins is pretty underwhelming. But I guess it's like the martial arts stuff, with Lee Byung-hun works for me, but also like the fight he has with Bruce Willis, I thought was really well done and engaging.
At the airbase.
Yeah, at the airbase. That worked for me. I don't know, like, is there that many memorable big set pieces in the first Red that jump out to me? Other than, you know, you said the car scene.
The fight at the docks with the RPG is a bit, where they shoot the RPGs at each other and it blows up in the middle. That's the other bit that I said that sort of jumps out to me.
Yeah.
And then you've got, like, Helen Mirren and that whole, like, in the gala ball where she's firing a chain gun and stuff, and that's quite fun.
It's more like, I feel like the Red movies, what tends to stick more is a shot. So it's Helen Mirren standing at an RP or at like a, you know, Gatling gun or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that shot of the RPGs hitting.
Is it just Helen Mirren? Helen Mirren firing two guns is what Henry said. You mentioned the chain gun. Is it just Helen Mirren? Is that what we love?
It is. And I think there was, especially at this point in time, there was a novelty to Helen Mirren, classy actress, you know, Oscar winner for The Queen, showing up at a Gatling gun, or in this movie, standing behind, you know, a sniper rifle. Like, there was something about that that was so easy to market and people thought was so much fun. And I don't know that that connects the same way now in the wake of the Fast and Furious movies and also, you know, the Shazam 2 stuff. So, like, I don't know that that is something that is seen as particularly novel now, but at the time, it was really fun.
Are you saying once you've stood next to Vin Diesel, you become uncool?
She's the only actress I think I've ever seen generate chemistry with Vin Diesel.
There is actual sexual chemistry there. You are very right. There's more sexual chemistry between Vin Diesel and Helen Mirren than there is between Bruce Willis and Mary Louise Parker.
It's like the whole audience was sweating at the end of that scene.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, before we wrap it up with the knock list, I'll throw it out to any final notes that people have. Henry, anything else you want to mention about the film?
No, I think I've said everything I need to say.
Sure thing. What about you, Cam?
I've got a few things. I was amused at the start where Bruce Willis is saying they need to move to Canada because it's the high ground and they'd have a kill zone. I'm like, wow, is that what we're known for? I had no idea. And I guess the fact the movie was shot in Quebec underlines the joke on that one a little more.
Sure.
The only other thing I had was I actually thought David Thewlis was actually really fun as the frog. And you get the whole, you know, stunt sequence where he's on the bicycle and they're chasing him, or the motorbike, I should say, not the bicycle. David Thewlis can pedal like nobody.
That boy flies.
He's like E.T. He's like flying. No, I thought that like David Thewlis, again, he's the guy you want for these small roles like this because he really pops and he's fun. And you get the big scene of Mary Louise Parker seducing him. And it worked. I thought, like, we were saying there wasn't as many new additions to the cast as you'd perhaps expect. But at least injecting character actors like David Thewlis goes a long way with me.
I mean, when they're smashing his priceless wine bottles and he's, like, flinching at it, it's just quite a fun subversion of the classic interrogation trope, as you would point out, Henry.
Yeah. And also, I mean, just, I don't know if people know this, but David Thewlis did all of his own motorcycle stunt driving.
You mean bicycle, right?
Yeah, bicycle, yeah.
Yeah.
All of it. All of it.
All of it. All of it. Well, I've got two notes. One, I'm just going to keep on reminding myself that Catherine Zeta-Jones said bald men are sexy. Thank you. that's the memorable moment I'll take away from this film. And I want to tip my hat to this film. The first film didn't do this, but the second film has these interesting transition shots that come up a couple of times that use the comic book style from the comic books, the art style they use in the comic books. And I think there's like an intro sequence as well that does the same thing. You get sort of character illustrations in the style that the graphic novel was done. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was just sort of a nice nod to probably fans of those comic books and, you know, just people who know a little bit about the lore of Red.
Well, I thought like the score, which is done by Alan Silvestri, was rather anonymous through the movie, but it starts off.
I didn't even notice it. Yeah.
But it starts off really strong. Like those images, and they had kind of this electro music playing. I was like, this is actually really cool. Like this is kind of launching the movie.
Well, I thought that was a nice note to finish off on, but let's get to the knock list itself. The reason we are here to find the best spy films of all time. Red 1 didn't make the list, but Red 2. It's got its fans in this episode. Could it make the list? We'll find out. Henry, you're our guest. You're up first. Is Red 2 making the list of the best spy movies of all time?
No.
Succinct. I like it.
Yeah, why not?
Because I don't think parodies are generally that well regarded. It, you know, at heart, it's a parody, right?
It is, yeah. Are there any spy parodies that do jump out to you as movies you would have to include? I guess Doctor Strangelove somewhat counts there.
Right. I'll say it, but I don't mean it.
Okay.
Casino Royale, the 1969 one.
Oh.
I have a secret crush on that film. I write it love letters every Valentine's Day. It's not a perfect film, but it has its moments.
Not a perfect film.
I'll just I only said it to make, you know, Bond fans' heads explode.
If you mention that on like Bond forums about some, you mentioned like the great cinematography in the film or something like that, people will lose their minds.
Yeah.
It's a really fun thing. It's like a fun grenade to throw into a room and then walk off.
Yeah, it's like saying the Blade Runner got its title from a classic science fiction book by Norse.
That one flew over my head.
Yep, well over my head.
The movie Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Okay. Picked up its title from a 1969 or 1970 science fiction book that has nothing to do with the movie.
Oh.
The screenwriter of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep just liked the title.
Yeah, Philip K. Dick.
So he just put it down as a working title, and the director liked it. So that's why they... That's how Blade Runner, the movie, got made.
It is a great title.
It's a catchy title. Yeah, I'll give it that.
It is a great title. Now, who was contracted to write the screenplay for the original Blade Runner? Not the Philip K. Dick, but the Norse.
Pass.
Yeah, I'd have to look that one up.
Pass? William S. Burroughs. William S. Burroughs.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
It's actually about doctors. Blade Runner is actually about underground medicine.
Interesting.
That's a whiplash.
Huh.
Yeah.
Hmm.
The book isn't bad. It's just unfortunately titled because the movie stole the title.
Yeah, it's happened before.
Yeah.
Okay, well, there you go. So that's one no from Henry. I think everyone knows what my vote is, but Cam, can you give Red some sort of a graceful funeral?
Christmas is over, Scott. And that's when we covered the first Red. No, I mean, to me, like, I just, as I said up front, like, to me, this is about on par, pretty close to the mm-hmm. first Red. But I didn't think the first Red was one of the all-time great spy films, and I don't think this is either. This, to me, like the first one, though, feels like a movie that in a different era would have played on TV constantly and would have built up a lot of love over time because of that. And I don't know that kind of love, other than, you know, obviously Henry's a big fan of the series, but I don't know that Red has the reputation it might have had it been made, you know, 15, 20 years earlier.
No, I see what you mean. It could sort of go into that cult film box a little bit. Maybe not a cult film, but something like an 80s film that just gets played on television a lot. I could see it having that audience if it came out at the right time. Like a canon film or something like that.
Roadhouse?
Yeah, Roadhouse is a great example, yeah, because there's so many movies that became really popular because of television, mm-hmm. and I look at, you know, if you wanted to show Star Wars on TV, that's expensive, but if you wanted to license Overboard back in the day, which was a box office underperformer, no problem, and Overboard is like a absolutely beloved, although now problematic, romantic comedy from the 1980s because of heavy, heavy TV rotation. And I think something like Red 1 and 2 would have had that kind of level of popularity. I think they're enjoyable enough that they're breezy, that they mm-hmm. would make really good afternoon watches. But when we're looking at the knock list, we're tending to look for the ones that belong in the pantheon of the all-time greats. And I don't think the Red movies measure up. But I can see that they would have especially value in a different era. But they do have their own value as it is.
Okay, well, that's two no's, so my vote means nothing, but you all know what it is. It's a big, fat no. No from me. You know, it's an unfocused film. in my book. I feel like it probably could have just, I don't know, ruminated a bit longer. It could have just gone through a couple of more script checks and filtered down a bit more, and you might have had something interesting there. But I don't think they had a story to tell. I think they just wanted to have these characters in spy situations again because the last time it was interesting. But that first time was based on a plot from a book, so they had something to go off of. This is just... Well, Lucy. I mean, the whole him being pulled back in was kind of the premise of the book too. So that they went yes and from there. This felt like it didn't have that starting point, and so they just kind of guessed their way through just the regular spy tropes that we see in a lot of the films that we cover more frequently in the last couple of decades, I'd say. But yeah, still moments to enjoy, bits to like in the film, but I think it's a step down from the first one. I'd recommend if people were going to watch a Red film, I'd say stick to the first one.
Well, question for the room. Should there have been a Red 3?
Henry?
I'm going to say it would depend on the writing.
Yeah.
But it looks to me, between the two of them, and I'll disagree a little bit, that if you're going to watch one, you should, you know, if you're going to watch one, you should watch both of them. But it looked to me as if they took it as far as they could. They took this exploring the tropes, espionage tropes, as far as they could.
Yeah, it's almost like you'd want to wait another, 15, 20 years until more tropes have popped up in a different generation of spy movie storytelling and then poke fun at those versus having three movies come out very quickly, one after another.
Right. I can't think of a single espionage cliche that they didn't explode. You know, everything from the femme fatales to the fast cars to the exotic weaponry. It looks like they've pretty much covered all their bases.
Yeah, Cold War intrigue, yeah.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Three no's. Red 2 is not making the knock list. The dossier on the film is complete and filed as classified. Thank you all for listening to our discussion, and thank you to our guest, Henry. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. This is always a good time.
It's a pleasure, as always, to have you on the show. And yeah, we mentioned up front, you're a writer. You've got a few books on sale. Where can people find more from you online, pick up your books?
Amazon.
Okay.
They're all there up on Amazon, from Spycraft, which I've co-written, to the Spy Sites of New York, Spy Sites of Washington, Spy Sites of Philadelphia, and then Honey Trapped.
Well, we'll have links in the show notes below and more online yourself. Where can you be found? Places like Twitter, where can people find you?
On Twitter, I'm at Spies Vespers. If people can figure out the joke behind the handle, I'd be very impressed.
I'll leave that there because I want people to have a think about it, and they can come find you on Twitter/X/ whatever you call it these days, and let you know if they find it. But yeah, Henry, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show once again.
Okay, thanks so much, guys.
And your passion for Red 2 is very much appreciated.
I might be the only one.
We'll find out.
There you go, folks. That was our chat about Red 2. And I guess that wraps up the Red saga franchise? Duology?
Well, I guess stay tuned for the inevitable reboot at some point further down the road. But yeah.
Red boot?
Red boot, yeah. Maybe at some point in the future there is another installment or iteration of Red, but we'll find out.
Well, people are getting older every day, so I guess there are always more candidates for Red films.
Yeah, like, you watch, it's gonna be Timothée Chalamet starring in Red 3.
I thought you were gonna say Timothy Dalton. I'd be like, I would watch that.
No, Timothée Chalamet, so it'll be like 40 years down the road.
It'll just be the cast of Dune 2. You'll see Austin Butler, Florence Pugh, Zendaya. They're the new cast of Red. I guess they just call it Red again, wouldn't they?
Yeah, they're like, we're too old for this shit.
Re-Red,
yeah.
But the question as always goes to you, Cam. What are we talking about next week?
Yes, we actually mentioned Jackie Chan earlier in this episode, and we are going to look at one of his spy entries. There's actually quite a few. It's embarrassing. It's taken us this long to get around to Mr. Chan, but we are going to look at 1996's Jackie Chan's First Strike, or also known as First Strike, or Police Story 4. It's got a few titles there, but it's a movie that was released in theaters in North America, so it does have an imprint over on this side of the pond.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very much looking forward to talking about Jackie Chan and his work.
Yeah, he's an actor I've seen some of his films, but really not enough as I should. So I'm glad I'm adding this to my filmography because I haven't seen this film before either. Very excited to see what Jackie Chan can do in the spy genre because one of my first spy movies was a Jackie Chan spy film.
Yeah, right.
So your mission, folks, should you choose to accept it, is to join us next week as we take a look at Jackie Chan's First Strike, or whatever title you know it by. And if you like what you heard on this episode, please consider joining us over on our Patreon page. Over 50 bonus episodes available now, looking at lots of different films throughout the years from your favorite spy actors, not just spy films over there, but we also look at spy TV shows as well. So if you want an extra dose of spy jinx in your podcast player, that's the place to get it, patreon.com/spyhards. And if you don't already, make sure you're following us discreetly, as always, on social media, at spyhards, that's S-P-Y-H-A-R-D-S, on Facebook, Twitter, or X, or whatever you'd like to call it, and Instagram, of course. And until next week, folks, you'll find Cam and I shopping at the local Costco and arguing about our favorite types of toilet paper.